Spotlight On is brought to you by Lyte, the technology platform reimagining e-commerce for live events. You can learn more about Lyte at lyte.com/partnerships. That is lyte.com/partnerships.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight On. I'm your host, Lawrence Purrier. This week, the spotlight shines on Frankie Tan and Kelvin Lee of AuraStream. AuraStream was started to introduce an adaptive audio streaming technology that uses lossless, high-resolution audio digital files of the original musical performance to seamlessly deliver the highest quality audio that the consumer's network can support at any time, at any audio quality, over any device. AuraStream's adaptive audio delivery platform is used by services such as the Neil Young Archives, Prime Phonic, HD Tracks, and Presto Music to offer lossless, high-resolution audio music streaming and downloads to consumers. Frankie and Kelvin take us under the hood to talk about the technology behind high-resolution streaming, why audio and video streaming evolved along divergent paths, and what AuraStream and their consumer offering Brio are doing to usher in a new era of universal, modern, multimedia access. Enjoy our talk. Hello, how are you?
Okay, I'm fine. which part of the U.S. are you in?
I am just south of Seattle.
Seattle, okay, yeah. All right, that's great. That's very nice.
Where are you?
We are based in Singapore, Ms. Kelvin and I.
Oh, what time is it for you?
7 a.m. Oh. it's okay. It's fine, yeah.
Well, I thank you and I apologize. It's a pleasure to meet you both. Maybe we could start with a brief introduction. What do each of you do for AuraStream?
Okay, yeah, maybe I can start off first. So my name is Frankie. I'm a CEO of AuraStream. Kelvin and I co-founded this company about 12 years ago. And basically, Kelvin and I worked in a research institute where this technology was first introduced. At that point in time, we sort of understood that it would be something that would be useful for streaming, for audio streaming. And so when the time came, or about 12 years ago, we basically started a company to commercialize technology for audio streaming. So that's how we got started. Kelvin?
Yeah, my name is Kelvin. I am the CTO of AuraStream. I was basically interested in digital media since I was a student in the university. So I've been looking at various digital media like audio, video, and also image processing since a student. And so this led me to various startups, I would say. I started working in the research institute where I met Frankie. And subsequently, I was working on image processing in an aerospace defense area. And then I came back to digital audio much later on when I joined AuraStream. But prior to AuraStream, I was actually involved in a 3D VR XR company. So I was basically more on the product development side. So from what I learned in the 3D company, I basically brought back some of the new knowledge and I got involved in the AuraStream operations from 12 years ago until now.
I would love to talk a little bit about the work at the Research Institute. That's sort of fascinating to me as an origin story. What was the nature of the work and what was it that led you to believe there was an application in audio streaming?
My previous experience in research prior to the research that's linked to the AuraStream technology was basically in a university lab. So I was helping the professors to develop some ideas, publish papers, and so on. So with that background, I joined the research institute to mainly focus on commercializing the technology that has already been developed. So basically, it's more of an applied research development. It is to know what sort of technology is at hand that can be turned into a product. So it has several stages to it. One of it is to turn the technology that is published on papers and on shared in conferences and basically AES and W3C and MPAC meetings, right? So there is some kind of a software that is available for reference. We would need to then turn that software that has been written into something that can go into, back then we have the Symbian phones. It wasn't really the smartphone era yet. So there are a lot of development that needs to be done to bring the technology into a SoC silicon. I would say into a SoC silicon, basically. So some of this would then be also developed for implementation on FPGAs and also on DSPs. So this is a little bit more of a technical area. I can go a little bit deeper into it if you want to look into some of these details. But the research over there was very different from what I did in the university, right? So there is actually also more resources, I would say. So every team member would be basically looking at a particular platform. So there will be developers who are looking into the Windows and Mac environment. Okay, and then there will be two or three guys that look into the Symbian environment where they will have to then develop for each of this. Back then, I think this was the various models. Like we have a Symbian, I think 60 and a 90 or 6 and 9. Okay, so there are different series in the Symbian base, I think, you know, that we have to develop the SoCs for. I think that's basically what was going on back then.
So you're basically looking through a portfolio of technologies and trying to develop the commercial applications for them? Is that sort of...
No, not really. I think maybe I jump in here. Basically, I mean, the research institute was one that is focused on infocom technologies. And of course, they were kind of focused in the area of audio. It was a kind of an audio laboratory. And the background to this was that, you know, the MP3 audio lossy codecs were invented like 3 decades ago. And since 20,000, we have, you know, several advances in computing, in broadband networking, you know, in storage technologies. And so there was this motivation to look towards building codecs that would be able to support lossless applications, lossless audio applications, because, you know, the advances and the conditions on technologies that we were developing over those years. And ultimately, they were looking at then the idea of basically a delivery paradigm whereby, you know, you can have a delivery network that all sorts of devices can access content in high quality, regardless of what the format is, and then to be able to consume them ubiquitously, you know, across heterogeneous networks, and, you know, it can be consumed by consumers with different preferences. The idea then was something called a universal multimedia access delivery paradigm. Imagine what you have with actually video today. Today, when you're consuming video, the source video is a HD file, and you may consume video on a mobile phone, on a computer, you may on different networks. But what you get to consume is coming from a high-quality HD video source file. So it's a little bit that of this concept, you know, whereby across any network, any device, you're able to consume content based on either the usage conditions, environmental conditions, or your individual preferences. So this was kind of the genesis for what these audio codecs, this new generation of audio codecs would do. It would enable lossless applications or lossless audio applications to be carried to consumers, regardless of what devices consumers were consuming them on. And as you know, this has not been the same for music. For over the last 35, 30 years, music has been delivered in lossy quality. They may start with a CD quality file, but they deliver to you in lossy quality, regardless of whether you have the bandwidth or whether you have the sound equipment or the stereo systems to enjoy high-resolution music. You get only 320 kbps MP3 quality or AAC quality at 256. So that has not been the situation for audio applications for a long, long time. So this particular codec development or invention, the codec was co-invented by Fraunhofer and the Research Institute. And it was at that time I researched that this codec worked well for streaming applications. And so this was still in the year 2004, 2005, 2006. So we went out, we took this idea out to the industry, went to see group in New York. The CTO at that time was a guy called Howie Singer. So Howie was kind of like the audio futurist. So he envisaged a system whereby, you know, this technology could be used on mobile, on very well on mobile phones, as you know, mobile devices have very variable quality of service networks. This codec would enable the quality of audio to be scaled at lossless quality if you have a good network. But if you get into, say, the train station, the underground, and your network gets degraded, it will scale to a lossy quality as if you are listening to, I know, a 96 kilobits audio stream. So he encouraged us, you know, to go back to the research and basically ask them to research on a streaming application and by way of an adaptive server so that you can adapt this particular audio codec for those varying network conditions for mobile streaming. And this was just in 2005, 2006. So Spotify, in fact, at the time, wasn't even launched, you know. So this was even way before, you know, the first. I mean, of course, Rhapsody was already a streaming service, so there was some reference there to look at. But how we kind of foresee that this is going to be a big way of consuming music going forward, and this technology would play a role, you know, in kind of encouraging the development of streaming audio, streaming music, not just in terms of accessibility, but in terms of better audio quality. So we got back to the research institute and said that, you know, and told the researchers and saying, oh, this is our feedback. And yeah, it's something that is novel and new and innovative. And this is one possible application. So they took a couple of years to basically build out a streaming system of being able to sort of sense what's the bandwidth, prevailing bandwidth on a client device, on a player device on a real-time basis, and then to then get that information to adapt the audio quality when it's streamed to them in real-time basis. So when that prototype was ready, they basically looked me up and said that, hey, we've got this ready, can you see the demo? And I watched it and I thought, it's kind of like they've taken advice from the industry and they developed this. And so I contacted Kelvin and then we decided to sort of put together some friends and family with some seed funding and went and got a government grant. And actually, we at that time sought help from Howie as well. And Howie put us with RDO. RDO was a San Francisco-based ranked service. And we went and visited them and we actually developed a prototype for them. And the CTO at that time tested it. And he said, hey, guys, this works very well. I was in my home. It was Wi-Fi. I left my home. It switched back to 3G, you know. At that time, it was 2.5G, I think, at that time, 2012, I think, 2012. And he said, it works, you know. So I said, well, you know, so how can we implement this into the RDO service? So he said, well, that's a different thing. This is just, you know, a server and a player that you have. For delivering music services like RDO, we need the system to be part of a delivery platform where we host our servers on, at that time was our Edgecast networks, and we need to encode our content. You know, we have like, that time was like probably 20 million content that needs to be re-encoded in this format. And so it's not going to be so simple. Then he put me in touch with the people at Edgecast. I went and visit them. And so I came back and told Kelvin that we can't commercialize this just as a server and client demo or a working demo. We need to basically build a delivery solution that incorporates this technology and then deliver this as an end-to-end solution for potential music services. And so that's what we had to do. You know, we spent the next 3 years reconfiguring the team, and Kelvin basically put the stuff together. Kelvin was an embedded systems engineer. And so we were a small team and small company. We didn't raise any venture funding. You know, the music industry was still in the throes of a depression, and very slowly put this into a platform and end-to-end solution sitting on Edgecast networks, running on leased servers from Edgecast. And we took this platform, in this case, still a working end-to-end solution, and we developed two music services. One was for EDM, electronic dance music. So we call it Dance HD. And another was Classical HD, where we went and licensed content from Nexos. Jeff Vandrill from Nexos in the US, based out of Tennessee. And he very kindly, some of Nexos material for us. And we demonstrated these two applications on mobile apps, Android and iOS. And the dance application EDM was very popular. It was a free demo app. It was downloaded 100,000 downloads, you know, in like 2 months, you know, in developing countries like the Philippines, Algeria, Mexico, you know, those places. We didn't do any advertising. So I guess those apps went on those app stores because, you know, they were kind of like the only free music apps around. And then we took the Dance HD to Nexos and we showed them what Dance HD was. And Nexos is a very innovative company. They are early adopters of technology. So they decided to basically license our technology and build a service called Classics Online, which is the first high-resolution classical music sharing service back in 2015. And they ran it for 2 years after 2016. Sony's content there, their own Nexos content there. But unfortunately, they didn't basically generate enough subscribers, you know, in the first 2 years to basically pay the advances for Sony and all that. So they decided that it was not kind of profitable to continue, you know. So they decided to stop the service and revert back to just licensing, you know, their classic content to OTSPs around the world, which they continue to do today. And so that door closed, but it was the tail end of the Pono experience for Neil. And Neil was looking for, you know, something with Pono. He had tremendous feedback from his directors that everybody's going to streaming, you know, you should look at streaming. And so one of his staff been a subscriber or was a subscriber to the Classics Online service. He showed his bosses and this went to Neil and Neil saw, hey, this classical music is streaming at 2496 resolution. You know? So he contacted Nexos and Nexos put us, you know, in contact with him. And then we met Elliot Roberts, Neil's manager in San Francisco. And then Elliot said, hey guys, we're going to use this technology. So that's how our relationship with Neil started. And then when Neil used the system, we were able to sort of go to Primephonic. So Primephonic, they started a system using FLAC files. And in the Netherlands, a lot of streaming is in the morning, you know, work transit and all across the train networks across Netherlands, you know, from Utrecht to Rotterdam or Utrecht to Amsterdam or something. You know? And that service that were running on FLAC files were basically buffering, you know, on the trains. So after like 3 months or 4 months, they had really poor reviews, like 2-star, 1-star on Hi-Fi Audio or something. So they came to us and said, hey, you know, we want to use the adaptive streaming technology. And so they shut down that service and about four months, we basically enabled the delivery part of the service because their service apps were already developed. They had players, you know, all of the front end stuff were already done. So we basically worked on the back end side, the ingestion and then the APIs to connect to call for their front end call to service. So after 4 months later, they relaunched it and it worked very well. And you know, they got reviews back to 4.5 stars on Hi-Fi Audio and stuff like that. And so they were voted one of the best, maybe the best classical music service at that time. And so from Primephonic, we managed to go to Presto Music. It's another classical music service that's been running for almost 20 years in the UK. So we managed to convince Presto Music as well. And after that, HD Tracks as well. And this was kind of our initial niche, niche services that adopted this technology. Yeah, and then I guess that's how we transferred from research into a real commercial application and real production scenario, all in the space of, the original research started in 2003, I think. And then we went out at about 2005, 2006 for feedback from the industry. And the prototypes were available in 2010. We started down in 2011. 2015, we had the first Nexos service. And of course, that first service taught us a lot of things. And that service actually build a foundation for us to build a fully commercialized service of Primephonic and for Neil and Archives.
Between 2006 and 2010, what were the challenges you had to overcome? What were the technical obstacles? Or let me say it differently, technology aside, overall, what did you spend that 4 years doing from the initial industry feedback to having prototypes in the market?
the research institute, of course, have many parallel research initiatives right at the same time. And for this particular adaptive streaming portion, you know, to work on application of this audio codec, they basically had a very a small team of researchers that was working on how do we build and cope this particular audio file in a way whereby when we scale and stream, we maintain what we call channel separation. Mm-hmm. Imagine if you have a file that you're going to truncate at a particular frame and send them out. This is a two-channel stereo file. You don't want to do it in a way whereby you transform them into a two-channel mono file, you know. So there was time spent on how they encode and truncate, decode and truncate this particular codec in such a way whereby even at a lossy truncation stream of frame, you still maintain the stereo separation that was in the original recording. So this was something novel, and they then patented this particular encoding and truncation method as well. So, of course, the IP papers for the patent lawyers and stuff like that.
A lot of problems.
So the demo process does take a bit of time, yeah. And that's been the research development application that was being done in the research institute before they came back to us with the prototype. And when it came up to us, the patent was already applied in the US, in the EPO as well. You know, and when we took over, it was applied but wasn't approved and awarded as yet. So while we are developing the platform itself, we were also kind of responding to the PTO inquiries and stuff like that. And so I think by around 2013, 2014, the patents at EPO and USPTO were approved. So the codec is a ISO standard, so it's above under RAN rules, you know, random and non-discriminatory licensing rules. So anyone can access a codec. But when you want to use that codec in a streaming application, you need to encode it in a certain fashion, you need to truncate in a certain fashion, then that method on doing so is covered by the patent.
Can you give our listeners a little bit of context as to why the initial launch of audio streaming, or even before that, digital audio, why was it different from the way video is treated? You mentioned early on that video is a HD source, adapts to its playback environment or its playback variables. Why wasn't audio implemented that way back in the day?
I'm not particularly sure, but I can just tell you what I know, and Kelvin can jump in on what he knows, right? So I know that lossy codecs are very efficient. So you can get a compression ratio of 30 times with lossy codecs because you are removing data from the original file. You know, you're masking, you remove them. So besides just compression, you remove data. So you have very, very efficient compression as compared to a lossy codec, which only compresses, right, without removing any audio data. And with very modern, so-called modern AC and MP3 encoding implementations, they begin to make it very efficient. So really at 320 or 256, you do get perceptual lossless quality. Most users can basically get away with it, right? So I think that has, of course, one strong reason, right? That services, distribution services, have no motivation to change the codec, right? Because no one's asking for it to change. And the other thing, of course, the economic reason is that when you stream a lossless codec, because the compression ratios are much lower, the data transfers are much higher too. And so imagine a lossless codec is a 24192 file streamed 6.5 times, is 6.5 times larger than a CD file. It's 15 times larger than a 320 MP3 file. So imagine if I were Apple Music, right? I'm streaming, say, 3 megabyte for one track. That's bad. 10 megabyte for one track, let's say. If I switch this to CD quality, I'm going to stream 6 times 6 megabytes for one track. Imagine, if I promote 24192, which they have on the site now, it's 15 times, 15 times of. So obviously, you know, if you time multiply this by 30 million users, right? I mean, do you want to spend at cost where no one is clamoring for it? And also, at least no one seems to be clamoring for it, at least not in large voices. You know? So you wouldn't be motivated to increase or change your codec and send more lossless data to the consumer players, right? So I think that's at least what I know. And I guess on why it's easier to do this on video, perhaps Kelvin may be able to address that.
Yeah, I think with that business consideration that you just mentioned, as a backdrop, there wasn't basically then kind of like a need to improve on audio as much as they see that there is a lot of room for improvement on video. So over the next few years after they have basically started launching 720p on YouTube, they basically do a lot of, I would say, enhancements to bring this up in quality. I think the business consideration back then was weighted against improving audio versus improving video. So audio kind of take a back seat because it has basically separated what they think, you know, is good enough at perceptual lossless quality. Now, that is only true if you're going to be consuming music on earbuds, right? Because they use, I would say, certain algorithms, you know, psychoacoustics is the name of that, to allow certain components in your music to be picked up as a mass signal. So this could be conveniently dropped without having any perceived differences when you are listening through your earbuds or if you're really in an enclosed area through earbuds or headphones.
You know, Kevin, that's on audio. What about video?
Yeah, so basically this is saturated. They are just looking at that in audio itself. Yeah, but there aren't any like concentration on playing back on large systems like in a loudspeaker, in a home theater system. And those problems were actually more apparent when they bring audio and video together in a home system. That's where I come into the video part, right? So basically in a home theater system, they then magnify this together. They realize that video looks really tiny. I think back then you can go up to only a 42-inch. If you can get a 42-inch screen, it would be considered luxury. 720p on 42-inch screen, it doesn't really look that fantastic. If you put it up on a projection screen, you know, it looks even grainier. So what they saw on video, actually the same thing was observed for audio because these artifacts then get magnified on the loudspeakers, right? But they still think that this is good enough because the video part was more, the difference was more apparent. Okay.
Because of the visual component.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is basically easier for you to pick up something visually than to your ears, but your sensitivity is actually higher when it comes to picking up or differentiating a difference in sound. Okay. Your ears are actually going to be more sensitive than your eyes are. I think there is a research on it. I can't remember the figures, but it was a very interesting article where it talks a factor of like probably like 2 magnitudes apart. So I think that's why some audiophiles, they really swear by being able to listen to some sound stage differences in terms of setting up that. But I digress. I'm going to come back to the video part to say why there was room for improvement. Okay, I think against that consideration, there was continually technology advancements. I think 2007, that was the year I left the research company. Okay, but before that, I basically was in the Apple WWDC conference. Okay, so that's where I think smartphones become mainstream, right? So the use of smartphones basically accelerated the whole technology boom for mobile. So processing power just kind of improved by leaps and bounds. Every year, you're looking at 30%, 50% increases in CPU. I think that basically got everybody excited. And then they saw that there was this gap that was left by video at 720p that needs to be addressed. So, and Apple was basically very vocal about their touch screens, you know, the high resolution display that were coming up back then. So basically a lot of resources were devoted to just putting the video side of things. And that happens up to today. You get to 720p, you have 1080, you have 4K, and now with the metaverse, you know, you're going to go into the 8K domain. You're talking about 100 megabits per second, right? And if you put this figure, 100 megabits per second, next to the audio, AAC is going to be at maximum 320. And that is 0.3 megabits per second, 100 versus 0.3. So you're looking at much wider, you know, and it is still widening disparity between what you have as a lossy audio versus what you have as high resolution video. In fact, the high resolution video is going to be much larger than the master files that were used for deriving the MP3 or AAC audio.
Yeah, that's a very helpful illustration, actually, to hear it articulated that way. So Frankie talked a little bit about the initial commercial applications being some of these sort of niche services or genre services. When you go into a conversation with a Neil Young or a Naxos or whomever, do you still have to solve the end-to-end problem starting with the ingestion and the encoding? Is that a service layer that you have to provide now?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. Yeah. Because these files use a different encoding method. So you do have to re-encode all your source files. But of course, you would then now re-encode all your source files in the best audio resolution that you have. So for Neil, he has most of them in 24192. So they are re-encoded in 24192. And for those that he doesn't have during the Geffen period, he has them in 1644. And so 1644 would be the source files. So we basically use the quality, the highest resolution quality of the source files. And then based on adaptive streaming, we deliver at whatever quality the consumer can support. Consumer's device network, all the consumer prefers to listen up after lower quality can support. And because we work with a single file, we don't switch between sample rates. We work with a single uniform sample rate file. You can interchange between lossy and lossless easily, seamlessly, to such an extent that, for instance, we understand that when you stream lossless files, if you're streaming a flat file, this is fixed. You know, you're going to have to stream this file regardless of how you use it. But with scalable lossless, like what we do today, you don't have to. So for instance, if your usage conditions don't require to listen to the full lossless, you scale it down to lossy. So I'll give you an example. Like, for instance, let's say you have a radio service like Pandora. Most of people turn Pandora volume down because they play it all over 8 hours a day in the background. So if you were to run a flex service on Pandora, you can imagine the data transfer rates would just increase multiple 6 times in overnight. In this application with scalable lossless, for instance, if you use Pandora with scalable lossless, when someone turns down minus 10 dB, minus 20 dB, the server reduced the lossless bit rate to, say, 320. If it reduces another minus another 5 dB, it reduces it down to 192 or eventually even 128. Now, when you lower the volume, your dynamic range is reduced. You can't hear it, you know, you can't perceive it. So it's kind of wasteful to stream a full FLAC file if you run a FLAC service, right? So you rather have a scalable lossless file so that you can scale the bitrate data transfer down as well. And that optimizes both on the service side as well as the consumer side. The consumer doesn't have to consume the bandwidth that he doesn't need to. The other bandwidth can be played on some video in someone else's machine or something.
So on a go-forward basis to... Because I'm very interested in sort of what's next for your system.
So for niche services or greenfield services, it's okay to implement, you know, directly SLS, a scalable lossless solution, because we're dealing with a smaller number of recordings. We're dealing with a smaller number of user base, small number of devices. You can do a direct conversion, or you can transition a direct conversion like what PrimePhonic did, without disrupting, you know, your existing service. But for incumbent services, it's just going to be very tough. So what we've done is that we've looked at incumbent services. We had opportunity to basically had a couple of calls with SiriusXM. And we understand that, you know, they are using HLS for audio today. So HLS is the same technology driven by Apple for adaptive streaming in video. But you can use HLS for audio as well. And instead of video profiles, you're using audio profiles. And in the case of SiriusXM, they use different AAC profiles for different network conditions. And what we've done over the last 2 months is to basically supply SLS within the HLS protocol framework. So in this application, so long as you have devices that can support SLS, you and their network is fast enough, the HLS will deliver the SLS adaptive stream above, say, 300, say about above 400 kilobits per second. Because AAC gets you up to 320 or 256 at the most, at highest.
So it just calls the appropriate file.
Correct.
Sort of simplify it. It just knows exactly, to hit this threshold call from here.
So let's say on web browsers, for instance, where the SLS players are caught by the browsers because of JavaScript. So you have them instantaneously. So anyone who places service on browsers will be able to get a loss of stream. On other devices, like in the cars or on a, you know, on a radio where you cannot get the SLS decoder in there because it's embedded flash in the network or something, then obviously they can continue with AC, the existing service. So over time, when you release your new updates and these new updates get flashing with SLS codec, then of course they now begin to be able to play SLS. Now over time, if let's say it takes 3 years, 4 years, where you are able to populate all of your legacy devices out there with the new SLS decoders update, you can even switch off AAC because the SLS can scale all the way down to 80 kilobits per second and you still get quality which is good enough, you know, for those.
So that becomes your path to business scalability, because this implementation with Sirius or this test with Sirius gives you a proof of concept of how to implement within a legacy system that can't be shut down.
I must say that we don't have such a thing run with Sirius yet. We're trying to show them that this is what we can do. Yeah. I mean, we understood the problem. We had a meeting with them. We understood the problem. And this is kind of we kind of devised this solution and it's working. And our next step is to basically get their attention to listen to it and see if they buy into it.
It's a prototype that you built to try to get their attention.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, it's a prototype that we try to get attention, that we understand this is the problem that incumbent and major services face today. The technology is great. You know, we can optimize data streaming transfers on the consumer side, gives consumer choices, preferences. And if someone wants to consume in high quality, they can. So on the consumer as well, and good on the service side, yes, it optimizes data transfer delivery. Don't waste data transfers or streaming a full losses file when, you know, the usage condition doesn't warrant it.
Yeah.
You know, and but still, you know, we need it to be adapted in such a way whereby, you know, someone can, incumbent service can adopt it. So we've implemented this within a HLS framework so that during this period of transition, you know, you can update all your players. Some may be updated immediately, some may not, and you have the time to do so. And once you are able to update the whole universe of all your devices with SLS, you can take away the AAC codec as well, because the licensing cost for AAC is still quite high. Yeah.
And so what's your business model? Do you also have a licensing cost, or are you a service model? How do you work?
Yeah, it depends on our customers. I mean, we are such a small company, you know. So when we have PrimePhone as our customer, they have a full technical team. So we basically implement our technology and we collect a server license and decoder license from them on a quarterly, or server license are annually and decoder license are quarterly. We count on how many users, new users, and then based on a per user basis. So this is the same for Presto. For HD Tracks, it's a bit different. HD Tracks, they don't have a full technical team. So after we deliver the system, we provide the technical support as well. So we run their backend for them. We run dev development ops for them for a service fee after the system is delivered to them. Also for HD Tracks, it's quite interesting because they had always been a download service, and they still are a download service, and of course they know that streaming is a lot more competitive, but they wanted a system whereby if they had decided to go into streaming, they could switch it on immediately. So with our system, you know, we are able to store the one SLS file in the highest resolution, and when someone buys a download, they say I want it in FLAC. We basically take the SLS file, convert into WAV, and go into FLAC and deliver into FLAC. All this is done on the fly.
So you encode on the fly.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. And so someone who says that, okay, I want just in WAV. So we convert them in WAV and we deliver them in WAV or AIFF or ELEC as well. So we see this technology basically kind of fulfills the idea of a universal multimedia paradigm. Regardless of what is the original source format, regardless of what your network you're pulling this from, what device you're using with, and what preference you have, this delivery system achieves that. So we've been able to demonstrate this on HD Tracks on our own locker as well. So we have a Brio, which is a music locker. I mean, why we use website Brio is because, you know, we found that the recording industry is clearly, you know, major labels have all of the bargaining power, and it's very hard, you know, to really start innovative systems or solutions, you know, because the bar to license content is just too high. And we said that in order to get our technology in the hands of consumers, or consumers, you know, who kind of value audio quality, we decided to build a locker service. And of course, at the time, we kind of saw that, you know, the law cases were leaning towards personal use for music locker, provided users upload this music themselves as proof that they own this music. And since fractional storage was not a problem in terms of personal use, so we were encouraged to develop a music locker application. And so that's what we did. So we developed Brio over the years during those periods when we were not working actively for our customer. So Brio was our kind of like project. So it took us like 4 years, you know, to build Brio to what it is today. You know, so today Brio accepts any high-res format. It could be DXD, DSD, surround, MQA even, in spite of all the controversies, MQA as well. Of course, PCM, FLAC, ALAC, all of your high-res formats. Now, for all those formats that are not non-PCM based, we keep them in their original native condition so that our Brio customers can download them back at any time they require to do so. And because of fractional storage, we kind of felt that we see that on our customers, a lot of them are Neil archives, are Neil's supporters or Neil's fans. And so every time Neil has an album, they purchase it, they upload it into our system, and we find that maybe 30 real users are uploading the same album. So we don't store 30 albums, we just store one. And then we said that, you know, since fractional storage is working because it is the service that it appeals to a common class of consumers, all with high-res music, and most of them share very similar music tastes. So we said to basically open Brio with unlimited storage. You know, you can upload as much as you like. So we have customers who have 6 terabytes of music. So they're using it kind of like a cloud archive service as well. We think that's a good thing because we don't have to call. Because of rational storage, I think we can afford that.
And so Brio is essentially your direct-to-consumer offering right now?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is our direct-to-consumer offering, which is basically targeted at music aficionados and people who say, hey, I want to access my own personal music on a mobile device, you know, anywhere I go. So that's kind of targeted at them. And for Brio, we've also developed a desktop app, which is a free license, you know, because the desktop is capable of playing PC on PCM, capable of playing all the high-res files, AC, MP3, of course, and it has audio file features like auto sample rate matching, exclusive mode, gapless playback, and stuff like that. So we kind of just want to put this desktop player with consumers who don't have to pay a license, you know, for a higher specification audio file grade desktop player. So if you just want a player to play high-res music and have all the common high-res features, then you can use our desktop player as a free license. This is kind of part of what we want to do to get consumers educated on experiencing high quality music, high, better sounding quality music. So in our desktop player, we take this UMA, use Universal Modern Media Access concept in as well. So for instance, we have endpoints that you can connect to, say, BlueSound, you can connect to Chromecast, you can connect to UPnP supported speakers, you can connect to Sonos speakers. But of course, in your local file or in your cloud file, you may have a 192 audio file and you're playing a 192. Now, if you try to play 192 on Chromecast, you probably don't play because Chromecast supports only 96. You try to play on Sonos, it also won't play because it supports only 2448. You play on BlueSound, it plays because Sonos, BlueSound is the only, so far, I think one of the few in-home connected systems that support 24192. Now, in those other endpoints where it don't support 24192, Brio basically, when it does a handshake, it knows that, oh, this is Chromecast. It only goes 24196. So Brio takes the 24192, downsamples it to 24196, and let the 24196 be delivered to Chromecast so that it plays. So for the Brio user, it's totally transparent to him. So long as he select the player device, he select the source, he press play, it creates an end-to-end pipe that allows the audio to be played on that particular device. You know? So that's what we call a universal multimedia access delivery paradigm. You see? So basically, that's what the Brio application is. So although it looks just like a normal player, there is kind of.
There's a lot going on.
There's a lot of people in there. Yeah. Now, and of course, all of these are developed by, and you know, mind you, we are a small company and Kelvin just manages all of this. There's just a lot of innovation going around.
Yeah. It's very exciting.
I think we're just very fortunate to meet up with different partners over the years. And even some of these are basically the customers of our partners. And they provided a lot of valuable feedback. But the reason why we say Brio was our kind of laboratory, a place where we test new things, is because, you know, there were all these questions and requests that came from partners and users. And the only reasonable place to experiment with new features would not be on our customers themselves. But we would like to bring it to a place where you can try new things. We don't need to be critically reviewed at that point in time, you know, when Brio was still starting out as a new platform. So basically, we were quite fortunate to be able to get a lot of inputs, a lot of feedback, a lot of questions going on. Eventually, we derived a set of FAQs that help us navigate through, you know, what to expect from Brio or not. But basically, that helps us to kind of establish the foundation of what Brio was back then. And I think this is still true today. You know, we use a UMA concept to say, okay, Brio is like that universal adapter that matches whatever sources to whatever destinations that is at home or even outside of the home. Okay. And I think this allows us to then build the next round of products and features directly to our customers. Like HD Tracks would want a better download manager. And so we would sometimes bring ideas that would develop on Brio to our partners. And then basically they would think, hey, this is, you know, this is great. It will work better for my customers. And in other situations, the reverse would be true. They would take the initiative to build those features. And we felt that, you know, these are really good features that can be used by our common pool of customers.
I wanted Kelvin to sort of speak a little bit more about what we're doing with high-res stream audio streaming in video, given that, you know, Kelvin told you about, you know, disparity between the focus on visual and audio. Kelvin, maybe you can talk about what you've done for live streaming, what you've done for record videos, what our customers have done with what we've developed.
Yeah, I think the live streaming part basically was something that we started on, I think, 6 to 9 months ago. So we started exploring what are some of the options in which we could use for bringing higher quality audio into first a recorded stream and now a live stream, right? But in the underlying protocol to deliver such media, it's still HLS. And by HLS, I would also bring in MPEG Dash, right? These two basically the two contemporary protocols that are used for delivering both audio and video. So basically, looking at the audio quality, continue on where I left off on that wide disparity, and it's still widening, right? We would want to be able to look at what is in the MPEG or HLS standards. Okay, and I think one thing that came up like in the recent years was the ability to stream lossless by including a FLAC or an Apple lossless segment, okay, into the stack of codecs that are supported within HLS and Dash. So we think, okay, maybe instead of using ALAC or FLAC, we could basically swap these two out and then put in an SLS codec and have our players handle the receiving and decoding of such data. So for other legacy players, you know, existing players that are out on production, they could just go with what they understood with the other underlying codecs, AAC codecs, basically, AAC and Opus. They could still continue to use that. So for us to do that, we basically started off with our web player, right? We integrated our AuraStream web player to work alongside with the HLS player. It worked quite well. They were delivered as two separate streams, video and audio. And once video is playing, right, we don't want any interruption to the video. So somehow we have to be able to do a synchronization, deliver the audio alongside with the video. And at some point of time, when the two streams match up, we would then be able to kind of like sync in.
Synchronize.
Lock them.
Yeah. On the two media. and have that SLS quality switch on after that. So this was basically the objective that we were just thinking of. You know, if we could demonstrate that, then that opens up a lot of opportunities. I think back then we were just going into a pandemic situation there. And then that gives us a lot of time to really understand how to do this better. And at the same time, you know, a lot of performing artists, they were impacted by the loss of income because public performances in live venues getting lesser. So they were looking at live streaming through YouTube and Facebook as avenues in which they could reach out to existing fans. And in the process, they realized that they are actually building a fan base. You know, it's not just the existing fans, but fans will inform friends and family. And most of these are basically also through like fans discovering new artists in the platform itself. So I think coming back to what we developed on the live streaming part, then we realized that this is part of a trend that was developing around the world. Okay, but not so much on audio quality. And that's where I think we think that we are going to be able to address a niche market in this space here by offering better audio quality in the form of a live stream concert, some kind of an event that you would basically usually would stage in a physical venue. But instead of being confined to a 40,000 seater space, you could basically be streaming that event outside to 40 million fans worldwide.
Yeah.
So basically, the idea of having no constraints with the numbers or the seats that are within that show or within an event itself, we would then be able to get them to really be immersed within the concert, right? With better audio quality and with better a way of delivering both the audio and video over, right? I think the situation with a lot of artists today is that they have been doing this on Facebook and YouTube Live. So they were stuck with this situation where fans are so used to having this as a free concert. It's a free performance. You know, how do I even monetize it?
But basically what we've done is to bring higher quality audio into video. So for Neil Young, for instance, all his new album, Bun, all the tracks, he actually has two sets of videos. One is available on YouTube, you know, in AC quality or MP3 quality. The other set of videos are available on his website, the Neil Archives, for his subscribers. Now, all those videos that he has streaming in 24/192 audio quality, he's kind of used this as part of Neil Young's archives, this artist-specific fan site. You know? And here he uses technology to enable his artists to get videos in high-resolution audio, something that they can't get elsewhere. If they go to YouTube, you get them in MP3.
Gets to control the presentation of his art.
Exactly, control his presentation. And we brought the same to live stream as well. So earlier this year, we basically live stream a concert, a chamber orchestral concert. It was a physical concert that was in a hall that sat around maybe about 120 people. And the chamber orchestra got a live stream out to one of the telecom companies in Singapore as a sponsor to sponsor the live stream to some of their enterprise customers. So in a certain way, you know, it overcomes the limits of the seating capacity. And because of social distancing, you know, the capacity is further reduced. And it affords them additional revenue stream by way of a sponsorship with a corporate partner. So this live stream was transmitted or delivered or broadcast in live stream in 2448 audio quality. And we had invited some of our customers to view it. And one of them was David Chesky. And he said that this concert was fantastic. He didn't know that he just felt that the musicians were so talented, you know, here in Singapore. He said that he wanted to come in Singapore and play as well. But I think part of that had come from the audio perception and of the quality of the performance, because you're listening this in actually 2448 resolution as opposed to what you're normally used to listening in MP3 quality. So I think that the sound quality has had a part in forming his positive emotive experience that he expressed after the show.
Yeah, that's incredible.
So we think that this could be something that we were looking to find, of course, more use applications and more platforms to put this on. Yeah.
Well, Well, I wish you the best with that. And I thank you both for making so much time to come give us some context as to the state of the technology and where you're taking it. And I look forward to seeing the platform deployed more globally and in more services. And it's very exciting to have great audio to look forward to as you guys expand your business. So thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity of having us speak here as well. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Frank and Kelvin.
Thanks very much. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Frankie Tan and Kelvin Lee. Thank you, Ant Taylor and the team at Light. And as always, thank you for listening to Spotlight On. Get and share all of our past episodes, write a review, and even send us a message through our website, spotlightonpodcast.com. If you like what we're up to here, please leave us a review on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, be safe and stay in touch.